Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details, or contact us at PR@speakuptalkradio.com. And right now, I just know we have a fun-loving guest with us. She is Kimberly Kimba Dolfries. Kimba, as she likes to be called, is a former Justice Department official whose publications, until recently, focused on criminal and juvenile justice issues. She's written on a variety of topics, including girls in the juvenile justice system, disproportionate minority confinement, community safety and mobilization, and law enforcement leadership. While at the National Crime Prevention Council, her responsibilities included the publication of the annual report, Mobilizing the Nation to Prevent Crime, Violence, and Substance Abuse. And on the flip side, she is a native Floridian who pretends to be a Virginian. And she's an accomplished king salmon slayer, estate sale junkie, and sometimes writes books, including I Was in Love with a Short Man Once and Magic Fishing Panties. I told you it's going to be fun. She's also had a limerick published in the Washington Post, which she emphatically claims as a legitimate publication cred. And you can find her hanging out in The Middle-Aged Cheap Seats, her blog. You can find that at kimdolfries.com/blog or visit her at kimdolfries.com. And obviously, we have someone whose writing history spans from serious issues to humor. So let's meet her. Welcome to the show, Kimba.
Hi, Pat. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's nice to have you here. We're going to have a good time. I'd like to know right off the top, what is it like being a crazy Southern Irish and a gal?
What a great opening question. So the gal's kind of obvious. Biologically, born yep. girl, a gal. But the term gal comes from, I'm not quite abroad. I'd like to be abroad. I call myself like abroad in waiting. Like they're great broads in history, Mae West and Shirley MacLaine, and I kind of aspire to be them, but I don't think I've quite reached that level yet. Southern, being that I was born and raised in Florida, which many people don't equate with being in the South, but it actually is the southernmost part of the country, so we are allowed to be included in the South. But I've been in Virginia for 2 decades, so hopefully they'll adopt me also as a Virginian. And the crazy part is interesting because I equate crazy with being lighthearted and funny and sort of a little bit getting in trouble. But I've had to be careful because some people equate that term with mental illness, and I certainly don't, you know, in any way, shape, or form want to offend anybody with that term. But you know, in the South, we make jokes that we celebrate crazy, and we actually, like, take it out on the front porch and introduce it to everybody. So crazy, to me, is a term of endearment for outgoing, loquacious, fun, energetic, a little bit get into troublemaker. So that's where that's where those terms come from when I describe myself.
I like it. I like it. I think I'm a little bit crazy as well. That's why I was attracted to you. as I just revealed, your days at the Justice Department had you writing about some heavy and dark topics. How did you go from writing to that type of works to a crazy Southern Irish gal writing?
Well, I actually still work in the criminal justice field, but back in 2008, 2009, I started thinking about the idea and looking at essays that I would consider publishing, and I sent 2 essays out in 2010 that were published. One's called Butter on My Head, and another one is called Rubber Bands. And one of the editors of one of the magazines that they were published in called me up and said, "Have you ever thought about doing a book?" I'm like, "No, a book? Are you? No, I'm not an author." She said, "Well, you should think about it. And if you like, I have a publisher that I think you should talk to." Right? Like, how does that happen, right? That just doesn't happen every day. Oh, let me let you talk to a publisher. But I was completely naive. I didn't know how any of this worked. I'm like, sure, I'll talk to her. One thing led to another. And in 2011, out came I Was in Love with a Short Man Once, which is my first book. And I thought, okay, done, right? One book, one and done. Great. I still have my day job. And it just kept evolving. I met the editor of Laker Magazine, and she called me up, and we went and had lunch, and at the end of lunch, she's like, "So, you want to write a humor column for me?" And I was like, "Sure, yeah, why not?" Again, no idea what I was getting myself into. Just like, yeah, I can write a 500-word humor column, sure. So I've been doing that since 2014 for Laker Magazine. And then the publisher came back and said, "Book's doing great, let's do a second one." You know, and you're like, okay. You know, one of those things where, sure, and that's how Magic Fishing Panties came along.
Wow.
So it's been kind of odd. Like, I never considered myself a humor writer until I actually started writing, and then I was like, oh, okay, yeah. But it's a very specific genre. It's creative nonfiction, which is what I've done up to date, which is creative nonfiction essays. So that's sort of a long way of saying I kept my day job, but that's how I pursued more of the humorous writing as well.
That's interesting. So it really wasn't a transition. It just was an organic happening.
It really was. And then I became involved in, there's an incredible writing community here in Virginia. There's the Virginia Writers Club is the oldest organization of its kind in the U.S. It was begun in 1918, and it has over 400 members across the Commonwealth and 11 chapters. And I got involved with that organization just in happenstance. And so I sort of building into my life this time to sort of explore this whole community, there's a whole world out there of writers and editors and proofreaders, and it's again been very serendipitous and on top of all my other life stuff.
Wow, what an interesting life you have then.
Oh, I guess.
Oh, jeez.
I have my moments. I reckon.
You reckon. We got a little Southern there going, folks.
Just a little bit. Yeah, don't get me started.
I won't. My husband's from Tennessee, so I know all about
it. Oh, okay. Yep. Yeah. So you know that the minute we start drinking tequila, we sound like Dolly Parton, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I get it. we won't go any further than that, right?
Bingo.
All right. Let's delve then into your two-book collection. I Was in Love with a Short Man Once and Magic Fishing Panties. Together, these two books offer descriptive and colorful essays on subjects such as getting a tattoo in midlife, which you and I talked about before we went on air, unique uses for kitty litter, which I have 11 cats, I can learn from that, handling a rabid bat, public speaking gone wrong, and naked, you say naked, I say naked, naked hot tubbing in Vegas. So tell us about these two books.
With that in mind, so the first one that I refer to as Short Man, that really came about, honestly, it got started with a conversation about my Nana's apple pie recipe.
Oh.
And here's how. When Nana died, she was an incredibly gifted scratch baker. And by scratch, I mean, you know, nothing from a box, made everything from scratch. And she really had an incredible apple pie recipe in her head. But she never wrote it down. So after Nana passed, we have spent years arguing about what was in Nana's apple pie recipe. I mean, family arguments over this and contests, and my dad and my uncle arguing on whether or not too much cinnamon, not enough cinnamon, if it includes lemon juice. And I thought, wow, if Nana had just written it down, we'd have this. And that's what got me thinking about writing down family stories, and in particular, for Short Man, stories about my son. Mm-hmm. My son, Jimmy, is an only child, and he doesn't have anybody to compare oral history with the way that big families do. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when my family gets together on Thanksgiving, isn't this true for your family? You tell the same story.
Right.
Over and over again.
Yes.
And from an outsider looking in, they're like, oh, for love of God, you told this story about Uncle Tommy falling into the well 14 times, but you keep retelling it because it's human beings want to preserve that history. And it occurred to me that I wanted to make sure that my relationship with Jimmy, especially when he was young, I wanted to sort of codify it. And so there's quite a few stories in the Short Man book that are about what I call Jimmy stories. And that's more of a gift to him so that he at least sees how I remember them. Mm. And so that it sort of puts it in perspective. Now, Magic Fishing Panties is a little bit different. So Short Man is really about Jimmy, family, relationships, and, quite frankly, some of my memories of childhood and growing up in Florida. Because growing up in Florida in the 70s, wild.
That's all you have to say, yeah.
Yeah. So some of those stories are encapsulated in the book as well. Now, the Magic Fishing Panties is a little bit of a twist. Magic Fishing Panties came about 4 years later in 2015. By then, I had joined Club 50. So, you know, firmly in midlife, I've been introduced to the menopause fairy, who is not anybody's friend, but every woman has to meet her sooner or later. And the second book is more about my relationships with my gal pals, with my, you know, the women that sustain me and have kept me going for decades. The impetus behind that, so how Nana's apple pie recipe really got Short Man going, with Magic Fishing Panties, believe it or not, and I'll probably get in trouble and you'll have to edit this out later, it was from watching an episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And I was watching it, Pat, and I'm like, real women don't behave this way. Mm-hmm. Or like the housewives of New Jersey, yep, or Atlanta or one of those other crazy ones. They just don't. Like women who are friends, for life, they don't treat each other this way. Mm-hmm. And it is frustrating and upsetting to me that portrayal is what will be kept in history, right? Like,
yes,
television is forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want 100 years from now for the historians to be watching those shows and say, oh, well, this is the way women treated each other. No, it's not. I mean, and no offense to them. They have a great big empire. Snaps to them, right?
Right.
But that's just not what we value. So the second book really has stories about what we value as women and how we support each other and take care of each other. And it has some other relationship stories as well, but that's primarily the focus of Magic Fishing Panties.
Well, bravo for you for thinking that way and bringing out the real side of it. Yeah. How did that title come about, Magic Fishing Panties?
Well, Magic Fishing Panties is one of the stories in the book. I was in love with a short man once. There's actually not a short man story in the book, but there's a theme. And when you get to the end of the book, there's a chapter that actually says, P.S., so what's the deal with the title?
Okay.
And then, but in Magic Fishing Panties, it's actually one of the stories embedded in the book.
Okay. All right. When I saw Magic Fishing Panties and I knew that you liked to fish, I thought maybe when you caught big fish, you had your special panties on.
The story is about fishing in Alaska. My family takes a fishing trip to Alaska every year. And for the first 5 or 6 years, the women in the family didn't go. And we finally were like, well, why can't we go? And the guys kind of rolled their eyes, like, you would not like to fish. It's out in the middle of the ocean. You know, you get seasick. And we're like, well, you want to let us try? And we've been now going for the past 8 years with them.
Wow.
So you hike up your Magic Fishing Panties and you get on the boat.
Put on your big girl panties, right?
That's right.
Well, speaking of a little excerpt from your book, if you don't mind, if you have one handy, maybe you'd like to read something from either of them just to give us a flavor of your writing.
Oh, okay. That's a great idea. I have a thought. Since you brought up Magic Fishing Panties and fishing in Alaska, I have a short excerpt from that story. Would you like me to read from that?
Absolutely. Whatever you like.
Great. Okay. So, this one is it's an excerpt. So it's pulled out of the story, but I call it How to Pee on the Sea. So let me read this to you. It shouldn't take very long. We gals possess one distinctive disadvantage out on the fishing boats. It's the head. For the guys, their need to relieve themselves is accomplished by a quick pit stop over the bow of the boat. For the gals, well, our equipment doesn't work that way. A woman's use of the bathroom on a fishing boat is a time-consuming process. I use the term bathroom here with a bit of poetic license. Often the facilities are nothing more than a bucket. You can take as many countermeasures as possible. You limit your coffee consumption. You definitely go at the lodge before you get on the boat. But eventually, you just got to go. So let me share with you some of the steps it takes to be able to pee on the sea. Step 1, The captain clears out the cabin for a little semblance of privacy. Step two, layers of clothing, being that you're in Alaska, include gloves, hat, scarf, rain slicker, all have to be removed. Step three, the bibs must be unhooked, but, and this is important, you mustn't remove them fully because this would entail also removing your boots. Step four, shuffle over to the cubby area under the bow. You're lucky if there is a cubby area. Step five, back in, derriere first, drop the bib tops that you've been holding up, unzip and drop your pants, followed by your underwear, and attempt to squat slash land upon the toilet slash bucket. Step six, pull across the battered blue plastic sheet that is supposed to provide some modicum of cover. Step seven, pray the toilet paper is somewhere within reach. Step eight, anchor your hands and feet against the sides of the cubby to steady yourself as the boat sways and rocks. Step nine, proceed with, well, you know. Step 10, attempt to rise, remaining in what a somewhat stoop position in order to avoid bumping your head. I did not forget about the use of the toilet paper, but I am trying to keep this classy here. Step 11, while remaining hunched over, attempt to pull up your underwear and your pants in the cubby. This is damn near impossible. Step 12, pull back the blue plastic sheet, and while once again attempting to hold up your pants and bibs, turn around, bend over, and pull the lever, which evacuates the contents of the bowl. Step 13, turn back around, continue to hold up your bib, and shuffle back into the main cabin. Step 14, refasten your pants and your bibs. Put back on all your clothing, the rain gear, the hat, the gloves, and the scarf, and head back out to fishing. Now I ask you, Pat, what could possibly go wrong?
What an exhausting ordeal.
Yes. And all the boys have to do is lean over the side. So yes, it's a little bit different.
Oh my gosh, I love that. That's awesome. I'm actually feeling the pain as you read. Like, oh no.
Aside from that, fishing in Alaska is awesome.
Oh, wow. I love this. So you really are quite a fisher person, are you?
I actually have landed a 35-pound king salmon.
Really?
Yeah. It's remarkable. Women, we talked about relationships and gal pals. Mm-hmm. Women who grew up with me are like, are you insane? We know you. How do you possibly enjoy fishing? But the feel of a king salmon on the end of your line, there is like nothing else in the world. That, it's a particular type of tug, and the fight that they put up, it's exhilarating. Oh. And I know that for a girl who values her pedicures, that seems really weird, mm-hmm. but it's a lot of fun.
Wow. Oh, I like it. I like it a lot. You're a very awesome person. So as you were writing these books, what is the underlying theme or message that you want your readers to take away?
I've pondered this before. Everybody has stories to tell. They do. Everybody does. And the getting them down on paper for no other reason, just to make sure that your family and your friends and your future grandchildren and your future nieces and nephews have that is a wonderful gift. One of my grandmothers ran the USO in Jacksonville during World War II. Mm-hmm. I so wish I had a snippet of a bit of what that was like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you think about all the people that have come and gone in your life, and if you just had one small reflection, one small fraction of something that was important to them or funny to them or interesting to them, what a great gift. And so I'm hoping, because I'm not that pompous, but I'm hoping that folks will read these books and think, wow, I'd really like to leave something like this for people that I've actually been in this world with. Does that make sense?
I think what you're saying is also very inspiring to people, because we all do have these stories inside of us, and maybe people feel, well, I'm not a writer. How dare I put that on paper and write? And the bottom line is, you don't have to be quote unquote a writer. Just get it out there. It doesn't have to be a New York Times bestseller, but your family will appreciate it at some point in the future.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, what's funny is one of my favorite critiques, I got an Amazon review, mm-hmm. that they had problems with the Short Man book because no child is that perfect. And I laughed at that. And I'm like, Of course he's not perfect. You know, I was a single mom for 7 years. We had a really great relationship, but it was a normal two-year-old. But no one wants to hear about his pouty threes or terrible twos.
Right.
You know, they want to hear about the time that he handled a rabid bat, or, you know, those are the sort of fun and interesting stories that you put down in a book. But people make their own decisions. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody, in fact, would want to write a book and include stories about how their two-year-old was a pain in the behind.
Right.
It's up to them. But I actually appreciate the fact that someone thought that I believe that my son was like this perfect angel. Like, he says, no, you clearly never met my son.
Oh, my gosh. Well, bottom line, it's your book and you can say what you want, right?
That's true, too. Absolutely. You know, I value everybody's opinion. I love that they read the book and what they get out of it. But at the end of the day, it's in right. It's not going to change.
Right.
You know? So,
right.
Anyway.
I got it. And you continue writing for posterity in your blog, The Middle-Aged Cheap Seats. Now, why did you call it that?
Well, I started the blog right when I was approaching 50. And so I wanted to be a little lighthearted. What's like, you know, what is life in Club 50? What's life in middle age? And the cheap seats sort of is a lighthearted way of saying this is not, you know, this is not like deep, dark topics about middle age and menopause and cancer or anything else. I mean, those are serious topics, but it's pretty lighthearted. Mm-hmm. I tried, most blog posts are pretty interesting day-to-day stuff, but it's not something that, you know, you're going to put in a science journal.
Right. All right. And the name of that blog is The Middle-Aged Cheap Seats, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So you're doing all of this writing and other people are enjoying it and they're getting things out of it and they're learning from it. What have you learned about yourself as you write your books?
Oh, wow. Okay. What have I learned about myself? I, true to form, talk too much. Most days. And here's another thing. When you write personal essays, you can falter, you can veer into sort of pompous territory if you're not careful. And, you know, sort of the look at me, look what I've done. And I learned that I have to, you know, sort of, there has to be a structure to these stories, a beginning, a middle, and an end. There has to be an arc. And usually there has to be a life lesson at the end. So that's what makes, otherwise, you're just reading somebody's diary. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's not all that interesting. So I've learned that in my writing that I need to describe things that happened in my life in that sort of focus, that sort of context. Mm-hmm. And so how it's affected me is that I have started thinking that way. Here's an example. I was on the metro a couple years ago, and there were two girls who got on the metro at 7 o'clock in the morning. Normally, I wouldn't pay any attention to it because at 7 o'clock in the morning, you're sort of brain dead. You know, you want to drink your coffee and be left alone. But because I've started evolving as a writer, I started watching them more closely. Pat, they were hammered. They were drunk, but they were dressed like they were going to work.
Oh,
they had like suits on and heels. But the more you watch them, you realize, oh my God, these girls are plowed.
Mm-mm.
And so a whole story started playing in my head about where are they going and should I be helping them. So becoming a writer has made me much more conscious of the world around me,
mm-hmm.
and paying attention to things like, wow, those girls are hammered. I should probably offer them some assistance of some kind before they really do themselves harm. But it was actually, I'm making it sound terrible. It was funny. It was really, like, the way they behaved in the car was very unusual for 7 o'clock in the morning,
mm-hmm.
put it that way. So maybe that, more than anything else, that's sort of how being a writer has impacted me. I just sort of see the world maybe a little differently.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you take the time to do that now. I find that interesting. And now you're also working on a novel. You've got one in progress, which you say is your first attempt at fiction. How's that going?
It's going. One thing that I've realized is that writing individual essays is one thing. You can get those done in a week, in a night. A novel takes a lot more time. It's developing plots and developing characters. I'm hoping that it'll be published in 2018, but I'm making no promises. And, of course, my publisher would like to see the manuscript now.
Yeah.
So please don't be listening because I'm not anywhere near ready to show it. But I'm also working on a third book of essays as well that is much more about men and women in relations. I also have a humor column in a magazine that's called Doctail Hour. And it's in Laker Magazine, which is it's a printed publication, but they're also online. So I can give them a plug as well.
I love that, Doctail.
Doctail Hour as opposed to Cocktail Hour, yeah.
Very good. And what's it, Lakers Magazine?
Laker Magazine.
Magazine, okay. And they can find that online.
Absolutely.
All right. So you're juggling now your novel and your third in a series of essays at the same time. And I think that's kind of an interesting progression where your first book was about you and your son and family life, and then your second was you and your gal pals, and now the third is men and women.
That's the hope. Mm-hmm. that would sort of be a good finishing arc. That's what we're aiming for. And you know, Pat, again, it didn't start off that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, when we talk about serendipity and what you want to do with your life, I really thought one book done, and so it's just sort of the natural progression of the way this writing has gone.
Well, I like that, whether it's writing or anything in life, just the whole organic approach to it is one thing happens, you go with it, it leads to something else, and you follow that along. It's just kind of that winding journey that takes you where you're supposed to be.
Yeah, and when you get into Club 50, you realize that you really haven't had much control over your life anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you look back at all the different turns and different places you've gone, and, you know, when I was 18 years old, I thought I was going to become a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't come anywhere close to going in that direction. So as much as you in your, I didn't even say in your 20s, think that you've got a path you're going to go down, you get in your 50s and you're like, huh, that sure went different.
You know what? It can go differently, but for many people it doesn't, because they don't allow themselves to get unstuck and to follow that. So I think that's something to bring up as well, where that we do have that ability and that option to not feel that we're stuck in whatever we initially thought was our direction.
Okay, I know that you're the interviewer, but I'd love to hear, so which way has your life turned out? Have you been this straight and narrow, this is my life path, or have you diverged from that?
I'll listen to you turn this around.
I didn't mean to, but I'm really interested.
Well, yes, and I have on many occasions followed what happened. I majored in music. I started in that field and wandered into my dad's field of business, which was financial services and life insurance. Met my husband through that. And then was really having a successful insurance company. And my mom fell in 2008 and had a horrible hospital experience where they missed her diagnosis, heart attack in the hospital, kept her there for 4 months. I quit work to stay with her and let my insurance business go. And through that, wrote my second book, which was called Speak Up and Stay Alive, which was about how to survive a hospital stay, which then took me to speaking events and radio. And then radio led me to interviewing authors. It's just, you know, it's not where I began or where I thought I was going to be. So I always like to encourage people to follow where they're led, because it always seems to lead to the right place.
It kind of does.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And hindsight's everything, right?
It is. I just want to give people permission to take your road and just wander with it.
Yeah. But also having a job that pays the bills.
Well, there you go, unfortunately. Sorry about that, folks. That still is one point we haven't figured out, right? All right. Well, we're getting close to our end of our time. Is there anything else then that you wanted to bring up that we didn't chat about today?
Wow, well, we covered a lot.
We did.
No, just that don't forget about your gal pals, because they become very important in midlife.
Got it.
Not that they're not important when you're younger, but my two best friends have been my two best friends since I was 14.
Oh, wow.
I have lots of other gal pals that I love and adore, but those two women in particular, we're actually taking a trip next week together.
Oh, I like that. I think that's a good piece of advice. Well, where can folks then go to learn more about you, get more of your advice, and where they can purchase your books?
There are a couple of ways you can purchase my books. One, of course, is Amazon. Everybody's bookseller's best friend. I actually also sell my books through my website. So if you'd like to order one from me directly and have me sign it or inscribe it any way you want and mail it to you, www.kimdalfries.com. And on that site, you can see there's an icon at the top where you can order my books. It's also currently available through Barnes & Noble, and they are available for Kindle download.
All right, so the website is kimdalfries.com. Let me spell it. It's kimdalfries.com. Kimba, I love you.
I love you too, Pat.
I don't know how else to end this. And I might leave it at that. So thank you for today.
Great. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.